some broadcasting issues, and then for a very interesting lecture that I heard good things about. So here I am on Halloween to talk to you all about science. And for Halloween, we are delaying stem cells one more week. I apologize to anyone who's super excited about stem cell genetics, but it's coming right up. And we are going to have an interview with my own very personal favorite professor, Dr. Mohammed El-Majdoubi, who runs a stem cell lab here on campus doing some cool neurotoxin studies along with other things. So he'll be in our studios next week, and you should definitely tune in. It'll be a great show. But for now, welcome to Splice Halloween! I don't know if you know this, but Halloween is my favorite holiday by far. And every year, especially since I've gone to college, it seems to sneak up on me. However, this Halloween, I was lucky enough to have time to put together a very quick show for you about the science behind my top five personal favorite monsters. Well, really, my top four favorite monsters. And then one I had to include just because, well, when you think of science and monsters, you can't really not include him. Also, we're going to go over some of my favorite mad scientists, both real and fictional. And then finally, we're going to close the show with some pumpkin facts to get you out the door and hopefully trick-or-treating. Because I don't care how old you are, it is never, ever, ever too late or too immature to go trick-or-treating. Trick-or-treating's great. Dressing up is great. I send kudos out to all of you who dressed up today on campus. Definitely made me smile quite a bit. If you're wondering what Trotula was, well, it's a little embarrassing to say, but Trotula was what Trotula was every day. A big nerd. Because she has a bunch of papers due and is in the middle of midterms. Well, it's another set of midterms. Anyways, so Halloween got me in the butt. We have vampires, zombies, mummies, and werewolves coming up along with Frankenstein. The brief recap of the coolest mad scientists that have changed my world, along with some pumpkin facts to end the night. And you are listening to Splice on radio.dominican.edu here. Live broadcasted from the Dominican studios from 6 to 7, like they will be every Monday. So, shall we dig in? The very first monster I want to cover is vampires. Now, y'all might be thinking of vampires in the Twilight sense, where they go outside and they glitter, or even the slightly homoerotic Anne Rice vampires. I'm going with the traditional vampires to look at the science. I'm talking about the burning in light, bloodthirsty vampires who also hold a strangely large amount of massive orgies, which we'll touch on briefly, very, very briefly. But first of all, vampires. What's the scientific basis for vampires? Well, vampires seem to have a different circadian rhythm, meaning, depending on which source you look at, either one, they only sleep during the day, and when they sleep, it's kind of instantaneous, so they sleep very heavily, or two, they don't sleep at all. So your circadian rhythm is the chemical changes that happen daily and cycle. So it's kind of your brain's rise and shine, and then stay and sleep every day. And it seems to be triggered by various things, both light cycles as well as time cycles. So there's a theory that a vampire's circadian rhythm is just a normal circadian rhythm turned on the head, where it responds to light by getting tired and to darkness by waking up and going out on the prowl. All right, so there you go. That's why vampires might have a slightly different schedule than you. As for the vampire's sensitivity to light, there is actually a couple scientific discoveries that support evidence that humans can be incredibly sensitive to light. There are two major diseases. There's porphyria, which is extreme sensitivity to light, and it's a nervous disorder. People with this disease can't go outside. They'll have extreme reactions. Well, they'll develop blisters in a matter of minutes, and in some cases, a matter of seconds. It also was attributed to why King George went mad later in life, was the idea that he had porphyria, and on a sunny day, it got to him and caused psychosis. The second disease, which relates to sensitivity to life, is polymorphic light eruption. These are small red bumps which appear on the arms and any area of exposed skin. On people with the genetic backgrounds of northern nations. So sometimes you are just too white to take the sun. And these are especially severe in people who weren't around sun a lot in their childhood. Now, one of the, you know, very, very essential characteristics of vampires is drinking blood. And we don't even need a disease for that. Humans drink blood. Lots of societies do it. It's cooked into a lot of foods. It has actually a pretty high calorie count, with a lot of protein content and a high amount of iron. So it's pretty nutritious, and it makes sense why cultures would look to blood to spice up their food and to make sure they're getting the proper nutritional value. So the Maasai of Tanzania consume the blood from their camel, which they let out directly from the neck of a live animal and mix it with milk. And this is a very traditional drink within their society, and it's considered extremely nutritious and beneficial. As well as many cultures who do not just let blood, they actually slaughter the animal and in the process use the blood with the meat to make foods such as blood sausage. Looking at you, Europe. So vampires drinking blood, not such a stretch. For those of you who have been paying attention to genetics, you might pick up on some things that you'd recognize when I discuss immortality in vampires. So let's say you somehow get bitten by a vampire and he transmits some sort of virus or bacteria or microbe or new genetic information, basically, into your body. There are actually some genes which can increase lifespan. However, there are no known immortal animals or animals who have survived a genetic replacement in adulthood on such a scale as, you know, having all your genes replaced so you're immortal. A lot of books put this as an extremely painful process, and some of them actually send you in a coma, and I think that might be accurate if it doesn't actually kill you to have your body altered in such a way that you become immortal. Because with our current science technology, we have come to the pretty strong belief that immortality has a genetic component, should it ever exist. So if you get bitten by a vampire, maybe we can have a genetic test for it. Not sure how they would transmit it either, but as we discussed a little bit in an earlier show, plants can actually give you mRNA. So perhaps vampires can make some proteins and stuff that'll help you be immortal. Send you some delicious mRNA as they suck your blood. But no luck as for trying to win immortality by tracking down a vampire. As of yet. All right. I don't know if you're ready for this. This is my favorite category of monsters by far, has been since I grew up. Every Christmas Eve in high school, I did some sort of zombie-related event because I wanted to relive Halloween before Christmas Eve. So, be ready. I'm going to talk about zombies. Zombies and the scientific basis for zombies. Part one of zombies, mind control. Can a virus actually change your mind? Well, there's evidence for this. For example, the Lancet fluke, which is officially named Coccoleum dendritium. Yes, it's Latin. I can't pronounce it well. Forces an ant host to clamp itself to the tip of a grass blade, where it is likely to be eaten by a herbivore. So this lancet flute then can carry out its entire life cycle in that herbivore and go out to infect other ants. However, as you can see, this fluke seems to control and completely change the the ant's behavior. So a virus can actually change the way you behave. Second example, also an insect though, is Nefarious bocolovirus, which is in caterpillars. And this is a really interesting one. It causes caterpillars to climb trees and it then liquefies their insides and eventually they explode on top of that high perch, spreading viruses all around. So while these are in insects, they are really good examples where a virus can actually cause an animal not only to change behavior or change emotions like other viruses do, but actually to perform complex emotion or complex behaviors which better serve the virus and don't serve the insects at all, and are in fact something the insects would never normally do. On that same note, there is sort of a human mammal equivalent, and that's toxoplasma, which is a virus which forms cysts throughout its host body, including the brain, and this can cause changes in behavior. Scientists at Oxford have done experiments using Toxoplasma gondii, which is a parasite, and it infects rats, and these rats with this over time begin to form cysts in their brains and they become very bold and they lose their fear and inhibition of cats. So almost like zombies would lose all fear and rationality towards, I don't know, a massive gun pointed at their head as they seek your brain. Toxoplasma can actually cause this to happen in mammals. So be afraid. So they also monitored the brain patterns of animals with these. And so these cysts not only cause the brain to change, but it causes the brain patterns to change. So your brain actually begins to think in different ways. Creepy. Yeah, you don't even lose, it's not necessarily that you lose that part of the brain, it's just your brain changes. So that's cool, a virus can take over and change your behavior. But what about the whole undead part of the undead zombie? Well, there's a couple scientific ways to look at coming back. First of all, there is the traditional method of killing someone and bringing them back as a zombie, which is attributed a lot to voodoo. There are certain kinds of naturally occurring poisons that slow your body's metabolisms to the point that you'd be considered dead. And it's been seen that even doctors can declare someone dead who's been poisoned in this way, and they will be officially medically declared dead, and the poison will work through their system, and they'll come back alive. So, an example of this, which you're probably familiar with if you enjoy zombies and the history of zombies, is the fugu, which is Japanese blowfish, and if not properly prepared, the poison from the blowfish can actually cause your metabolism to slow and you to go into a death-like dormant state over time. Victims can be brought back from the state using drugs or just your normal body's metabolism. Some of these drugs are like, some of these drugs are alkaloids, and another one includes Datura stramonium, and they leave a trance-like state which knocks out your memory, though it might not actually stop your metabolism compared to a poison like fugu. So these alkaloids leave you with no memory. They block memory formation, but they allow you to form very simple tasks like eating, sleeping, moaning, and shambling around with your arms outstretched. Sound familiar? Hint at anything? So, if you poisoned a population with alkaloids, you might have them wandering around eating, but it wouldn't necessarily make them do anything they wouldn't naturally do, like eating each other's flesh. It also would be unlikely to prevent you from reacting to danger, even in this trance-like state, because you don't need memories to react to someone's gnawing on your arm. In the same category of using drugs to change people's behaviors and brains and consciousness, Lunesta, which was advertised a lot, if you remember, last time I watched cable about 4 years ago, the butterfly would fly into the room and, you know, gift sleep onto the nice little suburban housewives. Well, Lunesta was shown, along with a couple other drugs that were meant to treat insomnia, to cause behaviors during sleeping. And by behaviors, I mean very specific actions, depending on the person. So, for example, a person taking Lunesta might get up in the middle of the night and just eat and eat and eat and eat and wipe out their entire fridge and then go back to sleep. All consciousness and memory formation was dormant during this time, but the behavior did continue. So perhaps a zombie virus or a zombie bacterium would cause you to cease memory formation, but it would still have you continue your behavior. All right, another aspect of zombies. How could it be transmitted? A lot of movies, it's either by bite or by blood. And this is very realistic. Many, many diseases are spread through bodily fluids. A very famous example that also affects your nervous system is rabies, which is spread by bodily fluids like a bite. And yeah. So be scared of things that bite you. Also, your mouth's a dirty place. So even if it's not a very specific virus in the bodily fluids, it can cause infection and all sorts of nasty things. So brush your teeth and avoid biters. Now, that's all good. We have, you know, zombies doing behaviors under chemicals and zombies looking like they're dead, but not quite dead. And we have these viruses that can change your behavior suddenly. However, what about the actual tradition, zombie dies, zombie comes back? Well, can you come back from the dead? Not as crazy as you might think on first looking at this subject. Zombies, not a reality yet, but could be. There's been evidence that comatose patients have been shown to undergo neurogenesis and to come back, though sometimes only with basic functions. This means that a person might go into a coma, lie there, and while they're resting in the state of dormancy, their brain's busy working, trying to make new neurons. And these new neurons can make new connections between different portions of the brain. And this can not only restore function, but also can actually make new neurons, which is a really rare process in the body after development, especially prenatal development. Most of your neurons are made during prenatal development, and so we understand it now that it's very rare, especially past around the age of 25, not only to make new neurons, but just to make new connections. So appreciate the neurons you have and try not to go into a coma, because should neurogenesis happen again and should you get new neurons, they will not be the same as your old neurons. Keep the ones you have. Drink safely tonight. Another option is a slow death, where the brain cools slowly, and this can actually save tissues by slowing down the brain's metabolism and causing it to almost go into this dormant state. And this could allow a virus to take over after a body has cooled to a certain point and the brain metabolism slows, and then the virus could reheat the body, restart the brain, but only portions of the brain. So this would be a true death and would lead to parts of brain death, but also could lead to the body coming back through this slow cooling and then heating action. This is actually performed by doctors during heart surgeries to try to save as much tissue as possible when your brain might not be getting the oxygen supply you need. We talked about it a little bit before in a previous show, talking about how they're looking at trying to understand how mammoth hemoglobin kept oxygen during the cold, cold ice age. And the final thing I have to say about zombies is the pure, pure evil approach to zombies, and that is nanobots. So scientists have looked at using nanobots, which are small machines that can go in. They've looked at this to try to treat cancer and other things, to try to have this programmed little worker in the body. But they did develop things called nano cyborgs, which are tiny materials like tiny silicone chips fused to a virus. So the silicone chip can interact with the virus and affect your body. So ultimately, you might be able to develop a small silicone chip virus to go into your body and attack certain regions like your brain and change things. Worrisome. All right, you're listening to Splice on radio.dominican.edu on this lovely Halloween night, perfect for trick-or-treating. I hope you listen to us in between your door knocking and your candy begging. I'm your host, Tortula. You are listening to Splice. We are going to take a quick musical break. We're skipping the news tonight, and instead we're going to continue on as soon as we come back with more monsters. My favorite monsters, including mummies and werewolves and bum bum bum, the famous monster, Dr. Frankenstein's monster. Also coming up, the top five mad scientists of both fiction and nonfiction, as well as some pumpkin facts. So please stay tuned to Splice. You're listening with DJ Tortula on radio.dominican.edu.
Fashion news, and enter our sweepstakes to win a trip for two to New York City and tickets to the Versace for H&M pre-shopping event. Click the ad now to sign up. Details on how to enter the sweepstakes will be in your mailbox on November 2nd. And as a thanks for signing up, we'll give you a 20% off coupon. Must be 21 or older to win.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down, when you're strange. Faces come out of the rain when you're strange. You're strange, when you're strange, when you're strange. People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down.
Welcome back. You're listening on this lovely Saturday night to Tortula, hosting Splice on radio.dominican.edu, where there's glad to have you this evening. Still up on our show, we're discussing mummies, werewolves, and Frankenstein's monster, followed by my favorite scientists, both historical and fictitious. And finally, we'll have a couple quick pumpkin facts. So I hope you're enjoying the Splice show to trick or treat by. And before we start back with our countdown, I can't avoid doing this one story about the eco-friendliness of Halloween. Just as science and society tie in real quick. So just an FYI, Halloween, like most holidays, not so eco-friendly. A diet rich in sugars and highly processed, like those little bars in the fun-sized packages, actually have a huge amount of energy and resources put into them. And most European unions and the European Union and the Swedish Council both tried to cut the diet sweets consumption by 50% for food choices. And the National Confectioners Association projects that at least $2.2 billion worth of candy will be sold this Halloween. And that includes a lot of non-recyclable packaging for those fun-sized candy bars, those individual servings, so we don't slip razor blades into your children's candy. In conclusion, since there's so much packaging in those candy bars, you should just buy everyone that comes to your door a full-size candy bar, and thus the candy to wasted packaging ratio will be much better for the environment. Though the actual candy eaten ratio, not so much, and the actual walking kids have to do to get that candy might also be hurt. But I, having gone trick-or-treating in Marin for the last 2 years, have realized the glory of having houses that give out full candy bars and sometimes seize candies. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And just so you have some numbers, a 49-gram chocolate bar has a carbon footprint of a little under four times that of 169 grams. So every gram of chocolate you eat, there's about 3.45 grams of carbon dioxide made. There you go. Back to my monster. Mummies. So, how do mummies work? Well, let's start out with how does normal composition work? So, then we can talk about how mummies change that. So, normal decomposition of a body in just ground burial has two steps. The first step is autolysis, and this is where digestive enzymes in organs and cells start to decompose and eat up those organs. So for example, the stomach acid in your stomach after death will eat through the lining of your stomach, which is no longer replaced, and then start to eat through your body. Sometimes this also produces a lot of gas, which can cause a distended belly that you might have seen on some corpses. So from this point, as your body starts to break down, you have areas where bacteria can enter, and since you no longer have a functioning immune system, since you no longer have a functioning body, nothing fights off these bacteria. These bacteria eat away all your flesh and yummy stuff that they can break down, and you go back into the earth from whence you came. All right, now you know. So there's typically two types of mummies. The first type is the desiccated mummy. And desiccated, not decimated. Desiccated means to be dried out. Desiccation occurs when all the moisture is removed from an area. And for an example, the classic Egyptian mummies and things like that are desiccated mummies. These cells, as they lose moisture become shriveled and the proteins become denatured and have little chance of coming back. And because of the lack of moisture, metabolism, life, decomposition is incredibly slowed, and you get a mummy, a dried, leathery mummy. The second type of mummy is the frozen mummy. You might remember from like Scooby-Doo episodes where they'd chip out this Iceman from a glacier and bring him to a museum, and then he'd melt and a mystery would ensue. So why do ice mummies work? Well, metabolism needs energy, so activation energy, and there's a lot more energy running around at higher temperatures, because at higher temperatures, all the molecules are moving faster. So at lower temperatures, metabolism is slowed, and because metabolism is slowed, decomposition is slowed. This is the idea behind cryonics, which is to try to preserve the brain structure as long as possible while preventing decomposition. And also, a catch with ice mummies is that you have to prevent ice crystal formation. So when your metabolism slows, it's all well and good, but when it goes below freezing, as you probably know, if you've ever tried to freeze a water bottle without pouring a little bit out, ice expands as it freezes, and that happens in your cells too. So if you freeze without some sort of antifreeze in there to facilitate the process or replace a lot of the water, your cells are going to strain under the stress of the expanding ice and eventually lyse, and a lysed cell is pretty useless. It lets all its insides out and can't separate itself from the environment and dies. So ice mummies in general are mummies which have been frozen in the ice, usually in water first and then into ice. It's a slow freezing process which lowers the amount of crystal formation and allows air to escape. Further, if they are frozen in this way, they are in an anaerobic environment. That means that there is no oxygen present, and most decomposition occurs with oxygen. So this lack of oxygen, along with the cold temperature, further prevents decomposition. And because of this, the body lasts longer, and you get an ice mummy. However, even though cryonics might tell you something different, science has not gotten to the point where we can defrost frozen organisms, frozen mummies, and figure out how to bring them back to life. So you're very, very unlikely to see a mummy wandering the halls of a museum anytime soon. Though if you do, ask who the scientist was, and I'll add him to my list of my favorite mad scientists. Nonfiction. On the same anaerobic note, they're more rare, but there are bog mummies and things like that. These are people who get trapped in mud and other anaerobic environments where bacteria cannot thrive since they have no oxygen. And because they have no oxygen, they cannot decompose the body. So the body sits there and begins to fossilize, but is not decomposed. So you have a bog mummy. All right, another monster. Ready? Werewolves. And though the Twilight series is a little ridiculous, there is some interesting basis for werewolves. There is a disease called generalized hypertrichosis. Hypertrichosis is just excessive hair growth. So generalized hypertrichosis causes excessive hair growth everywhere, and this gives sufferers the appearance of a wolf. There's some very interesting pictures of a family who has this condition online. In 2008, a group of researchers found that testosterone injections can actually help try to treat this condition. But it's very rare. It's estimated that in our just turned 7 billion member species, there are between 50 and 100 people with this genetic condition. So don't think that weird guy in the corner has it and is secretly a werewolf. He just shaves a lot. This is a very rare condition. There was some interesting historical ideas that it was caused by changes in the mood, and that men had emotional cycles like women, and that's portrayed in The Werewolf. So they wouldn't have a menstrual cycle, but they'd have a wolf cycle. There's also a psychological condition where people take on animal characteristics, if not think themselves animals, and they will display animalistic behaviors like grunting. They'll generally be more aggressive, they'll growl, and it was thought that individuals with psychological trauma before psychotherapy had developed well might have contributed to the werewolf myth. All right, before we get to our last monster, I'm going to remind you that you're listening to Splice, Dominican Science Radio Show. I'm your host, Trutula. It is 6:45 on a lovely Halloween night, and you're listening to radio.dominican.edu. And thank you for listening. All right, it's time. It's time to do my duty. Don't really like Frankenstein's monster. I love the book when I read it. Not a huge fan of the monster, though. But it's Halloween. I'm in science. You can't really cover science monsters without Frankenstein. So I'm biting the bullet, and here it goes. Frankenstein's monster. The basis for Frankenstein's monster seems to be experiments conducted about electrical controls of muscles. So your muscles and your nerves are controlled by electric signals along with chemical signals. So if you shock a part of a dead body at the right place with an electrode, the muscle will spasm and look like it's alive. So for example, you have a dead frog, you can put an electrode in its leg, and the leg muscle will twitch. Very weird to see, but not actually life. There are also the potential to hook up electrodes to move tissues that are not actually controlled by the brain. This technology is used in artificial limbs currently. So for example, if your arm got severed off, you still have nerves, but the nerves lead nowhere since you no longer have that arm. You can move those nerves and reattach them to different places, and then those nerves can be trained to move the arms, which theoretically, if you had a torso, you could do multiple times and perhaps make a monster who, like Frankenstein, when he began, is not very coordinated. Though there have been a couple clinical trials using this technique of reprogramming nerves to try to control artificial limbs. And over time, it develops more and more dexterity. So maybe Frankenstein in the end would learn to walk and control himself well instead of mumbling around like a zombie, though not a zombie. All right, other aspects of Frankenstein's monster include the possible use of stem cells or other cells from a body part to create genetically identical or at least genetically similar enough body parts. So for example, Frankenstein, you might, before a prisoner died, harvest some of his stem cells, grow a bunch of disjointed parts, sew them together, and you have Frankenstein, and the immune system wouldn't reject the other parts. However, getting all these parts coordinated and developed and functional takes 9 months in the womb. I'm not sure if it's actually possible to grow an adult from stem cells, and it's certainly not possible right now. On the plus side, if you do not have immune cells developed from these stem cells, you would not have an immune system, so you might be able to use different people's limbs without fear. Like I said about the pure evil zombies, there are nanotechnologies which can contribute to the development of a Frankenstein-ish monster. And these would probably be in the form of electric chips, which serve either to send nerve signals or to manually send signals to control the muscles themselves. However, if you're going to try to pull a Frankenstein and pull the monster into the lightning and scream, "It's alive!" Don't do it. It will probably fry all the nano hardware you just spent forever to put in, as well as a lot of your cells. When they shock the heart, it is usually not to bring the heart back, but to prevent an irregular rhythm. Shocking the heart is not a guaranteed way to bring something alive. All right. We've gotten through the list of my five favorite monsters and covered quite a few of the scientific related aspects of them. And it's time to go over my favorite mad scientists. So I have my top five favorite real mad scientists. And then I have my top five favorite fictional scientists, along with two runners up. Shall we begin? Number five on the list is Sergei Bryukonnikov. Yes, I know, my father could say that, but I cannot. I miss the phonics of Russian completely. So Sergei was a scientist who chopped off the heads of dogs and did multiple experiments to keep those heads alive. So he'd run blood and oxygen through to try to keep the brain alive. This technology eventually led to heart transplants, yay! But in the meantime, he also did some very, very creepy experiments with his dog's head. So for example, he would blow a puff of air into the dog's face and the dog would wince, or he would shine a light in the eyes and it would squint, or he'd slam down a book and the dog's head would twitch from the force. Very creepy. Very, very, very creepy. It's now known that there are some basic brain functions in the lower cords of the brain that help regulate these, and it probably wasn't a conscious response as it would be in a living dog. So that's Sergei, number five. Number four, Jose Hidalgo. Jose Hidalgo was the first scientist to try to use electricity to control probes. Now, neurons actually fire using electricity and send signals that way. Very cool. Not so cool to try to use it to control people, so he inserted electrodes into people's brains and saw what happened. This was during the Spanish Civil War. You might notice the theme that a lot of these mad scientists occur during wars and times where warring powers were interested in using scientists to work on evil, and ethics were kind of compromised. However, this using electric probes in the brain, while did not work out so well for mind control, is now used for epilepsy treatment and has been used in a lot of studies mapping the brain. Number three is Sidney Gottlieb, aka Dr. Feelgood. He's the scientist who conducted mind control experiments using LSD. Number two, my favorite, Nikola Tesla. Very antisocial, worked a lot with electricity. And not really mad, I don't think. He didn't do anything evil or, you know, torture animals to some extent. He's just a very, very interesting guy. And very reclusive, which is unique in the scientific world. And I can't really excuse myself for going over any list of top five scientists without mentioning Nikola Tesla, except for maybe female scientists. Sorry, Nikola. All right, number one, which I shouldn't be proud about. It's very depressing, so if you're out joyously eating candy, cover your ears for about 5 seconds. Joseph Mengele, who is also known as the Angel of Death. He was the SS scientist who conducted a wide variety of highly unethical treatments on concentration camp prisoners, including a number of twin studies. A lot of them involved psychological and body mutilations. It's fascinating and very disturbing if you ever want to research it. So those were my top five real mad scientists. And now for my top five fiction scientists. And they're two runner-up because I do love my fiction. and my fictional scientists. Number one, the fly scientist, who has gone by multiple names, but this is a scientist in movie adaptations and play adaptations and other stories based off the short story from George Le Guin, who wrote these tale of a scientist experimenting with teleportation who gets fused with a fly. This is probably the most famous adaptation, was done with Vincent Price as the scientist. Number two for my favorite fictional scientist is Dr. Jekyll from Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson, a great author. Dr. Jekyll likes murder and mayhem and to manipulate Mr. Hyde. I mean, sorry, Dr. Jekyll enables Mr. Hyde to do all sorts of murder and mayhem by altering his personality using a chemical formula and unleash his dark side. By the by, thinking a lot about trick-or-treating, not so much about the show. Sorry, listeners. We're almost done. You know it has to be my favorite holiday to distract me from a great Robert Louis Stevenson novel. Right, number three. Dr. Monroe from the Island of Dr. Monroe, which is a Jules Verne, which is by H.G. Wells. And it's about a race of animal and human hybrids running across the island. Number four, Dr. Victor Frankenstein from Frankenstein by Mary Shelley. Great doctor up in his creepy castle trying to make life from death. And then my number five is from Jules Verne, who's one of my favorite authors. This is Captain Nemo. Captain Nemo is the captain of the Nautilus, which he designs and runs all across the ocean because he doesn't really like humanity. Very, very cool books, all of them. Check them out if you get a chance. And now for my runners-up, both from old black and white movies. The first runner-up is C.A. Rotwang, who is the scientist from Metropolis who makes the artificial woman robot who runs around. And the other runner-up is Dr. Caligari from The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, who conducts a series of murders using a sleepwalking assistant put under by hypnosis. So, you're listening to Spliced on radio.dominican.edu. We're about to finish up with some quick pumpkin facts, but you've heard about the science behind a whole slew of monsters, including mummies and my personal favorite, zombies. We've discussed my favorite mad scientists, both fiction and real. And we're about to end with three pumpkin facts, which are wholesome to refresh your palate after all the madness of the mad scientists. One, a pumpkin is not a vegetable, but a fruit. Two, a pumpkin is made of 90% water. And three, the record pumpkin weight was 1,689 pounds. Thank you for listening to Splice on radio.dominican.edu. Coming up next, we have Hotspot with DJ Juice. After that, the Power Hour with Sam I Am. And finally, the 9 o'clock lounge with Too Mellow. So stay tuned, and you have lots of programming to trick or treat by as we continue tonight. And as always, remember, science is real. Thanks for listening.